This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson. On today's show, we're going to talk about voters in this country and their rights to choose the candidates they want. But we're going to add a little twist to the conversation. We're going to talk about Donald Trump and whether voters could be deprived of their choice if he's kicked off the ballot, an issue that is right now before the U.S. Supreme Court. And if that happens, what does it mean for voters whose rights were historically more vulnerable? Hey, Carrie, I've got a question that I've been mulling over for a little while, and I want to ask you to see what you think about it.
All right.
If Donald Trump can't be on the ballot in 2024, what does that say about the voters, the people who would choose him if he were on the ballot? And if you can disqualify somebody for being part of an insurrection without having been convicted of it, do you open the door to all kinds of other voter mischief that would be exercised against more vulnerable people, black people, female voters, other people who maybe don't have the proper ID all the time? I mean, these are things we fight about a lot in this country. And I guess I'm a little worried that we're inviting more mischief than we might be solving.
It's funny you asked me, and I'm glad that we have a guest for this topic because I am not the
You're
person.
Not a constitutional expert.
Neither am I. But in that, that's my response. I don't think it's about what I think it says about the people, I think, or what it says about voting and the access for candidates. It's about what the law says about that, right? And
it's about what the Constitution says, technically.
It's about what the Constitution says about that.
But one of the problems is that the Constitution is not really clear on how these rules get enforced. It's clear that they're saying this should be a rule, right? That if you participate in an insurrection and you were an office holder, you can't run again, right? You're out. You're not part of the process. But who determines what that looks like? And then who enforces it, I think, is one of the things that worries me. And then if you leave it to states, think of all the things that states do that we worry about the effect that they have on these vulnerable voters. I mean, people who in history have been left out of the process.
Part of this conversation is, yes, what does the Constitution say about it and how that language can be interpreted? But your concern is more about how the voters are impacted by what's determined.
Right.
Because you feel like they won't have the candidate of their choice as a result. They could not. They may not have the candidate of their choice.
This whole thing has been framed in terms of Donald Trump and his right to be on the ballot, right? I mean, it's a struggle between him and these states that have kicked him off, and then the court is going to decide who's right. Mm-hmm. But I don't see anybody talking about those voters. It's really voters' rights that are the most important to protect. So let's go back to 2012 and a former president, Barack Obama, who faced all of these questions. They were not legitimate questions, we should make that clear, about where he was born, right? Whether his birth certificate was valid. And it never got to this point, but that is also a constitutional requirement that you have to be a natural-born citizen of this country to appear on the ballot to be president. Let's say a bunch of states that just didn't like Obama or didn't agree with him decided that they thought that the questions about his birth certificate were legitimate, and they said, well, he's not going to be on the ballot here. The chances that gets enforced, the chances that a Supreme Court that's as conservative as this one is says, well, we'll leave that to the states, seems to me a real threat, right? In the current environment, in terms of the division between the parties and the racial division that exists, and in terms of the power that states now want to assert for themselves, I don't think it's unreasonable to think that could happen, or that if you disqualify Donald Trump, you're inviting that kind of retaliatory even authority being exercised by states in the future.
like I said, I am not an expert in constitutional law, but I do think that what Trump's behavior rises to a level that, with that example, it's a very different example.
It is a very different. I mean, look, I absolutely don't want anyone to be confused that I'm comparing, you know, disrupting the peaceful transference of power to almost anything else. But these are all provisions in the same Constitution, and they can be enforced by different states in different ways if the court, if the Supreme Court says they can.
And it's not about, for you, the seriousness of what Donald Trump did, but the ability that the courts
have. How do you manage that?
To manage what happened and make those decisions.
Yeah,
that'll be
an
interesting conversation
for
you to have.
And we've got, you know, neither of us is a constitutional expert.
Right.
But we've got one. Right?
We've got one.
Richard Primus, who's a constitutional law professor at the University of Michigan, is going to join us to give us his perspective, not just on what's happening with Donald Trump, but what this means in the current political context, but also in terms of what could happen in the future. Richard Primus, welcome to Created Equal.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so I think it's going to be helpful to start with just a little language. And I'm speaking specifically about the language of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It says, and of course I'm paraphrasing here, that any official who has taken the oath of office, then after that participated in or aided an insurrection, is ineligible for future office. I guess that's a pretty straightforward way of thinking about it. But here's some things that the amendment doesn't say. It doesn't say how you define what an insurrection is or isn't. And it doesn't say how you determine who has participated in an insurrection or helped one. So I'm thinking it would be good to have you talk about how Donald Trump, the former president of the United States, who would like to be president again, finds himself in the middle of this language and this controversy.
Okay. There's a lot going on.
Yes, there is.
It does say one thing about who decides. It says that Congress, by a two-thirds vote,
can
remove the disability.
Right.
Right. They say Congress has the power by a two-thirds vote to say that person over there participated in an insurrection or maybe participated in an insurrection, but we're going to forgive it.
Right.
We're
going to say that person is eligible. Yeah.
That we know Congress can do. Right. But you're right. The Constitution doesn't say how we decide in the first place who participated in an insurrection. This isn't unusual for the Constitution.
That's right. That's right.
Right. So think about the parts of the 14th Amendment might be the single most important, powerful piece of the Constitution as we know it in our lifetimes. It's the piece of the Constitution ratified in 1868 after the Civil War to sort of get the system on better footing again.
Mm-hmm.
It is the section that gives us the basic equality and anti-discrimination guarantees of the Constitution, right, in the Equal Protection Clause. It's the section that makes all the rights in the Bill of Rights applicable to the states.
Right.
Right. So, like, every time you assert a First Amendment claim against your state government, what you're working with is the 14th Amendment, right? We use the 14th Amendment all the time. And for the most part, the 14th Amendment operates in the absence of definitions and in the absence of seeing exactly who enforces in the following way. The 14th Amendment says that no state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. But there are a lot of ways of understanding what makes something equal or unequal.
Right.
Right. The 14th Amendment doesn't tell us that. We have case law over time, right? People take cases to court and say, I think this is unequal treatment. I think that's unequal treatment. We fight about it. We reason together. Courts make decisions. And then those decisions tell us, you know, what equality is going to mean for the purposes of the 14th Amendment going forward.
So,
and not just federal courts.
Yes.
State courts, right? The 14th Amendment is also enforced by state courts the same way. So here's what's a little bit different about Section 3 from the Equal Protection Clause.
Mm-hmm.
It's less familiar. We've applied it fewer times. All Americans know, even if they can't give you the language, that the Constitution has something like an equal protection clause. And there are lots of famous cases about how that clause should get applied.
Right. Right?
We know that the Constitution has an anti-discrimination rule in it. Until the last several months, most Americans have not realized that the Constitution, in exactly the same amendment, right, in a different part, has a disqualifications clause for people who participate in insurrections. And the reason that most of us haven't been familiar with it is that for the most part, we Americans have been pretty lucky in this respect about our government. We haven't had a lot of insurrections.
Right, that's true.
Insurrection has been relatively, like since the Civil War, insurrection has been relatively unusual. Not completely absent. There have been some people who've been disqualified for insurrection. But it's been pretty rare. And that means it's not a rule that we're accustomed to thinking about.
Yeah.
And not a rule that we're accustomed to applying.
And certainly there hasn't been a president, a sitting president, who, I guess, loses an election and then comes back to run again, which he's eligible to do, who faces the possibility of disqualification because of this. I mean, the other instances don't involve a former president, right?
No, nothing's ever come close. The constitutional system is not built to handle the kinds of issues that the era of Trump has given us.
Right. You've said that, right? But you've said that before, but I want you to explain that a little bit here. Like, what do you mean by that?
Here's what I mean. The Constitution works if the people who are exercising power within the system are, for the most part, reasonable people trying to do the right thing and who recognize the overall system as more important than their own particular interests in it.
Yeah.
Right? I often say to my students, the first rule of constitutional government is the same as the first rule of playground basketball. If you don't respect your opponent in the spirit of the game, if you're not willing to have fouls called on you and take your losses, the game will break down. Right? The game can't keep going. And in constitutional government, the way that applies is you have to be willing to back down from a fight sometimes. You have to be willing to say, okay, I lost this round, and move on. Because there's no ultimate referee in this game other than the players in it.
Right, right.
The American system has worked pretty well for a long time because the major political parties have been willing to take losses, right? Democracy relies on the consent of the losers. Like we usually say, the consent of the governed.
Right.
That's true too.
Right.
But most critically, it relies on the consent of the losers, right? The people who lose an election have to be willing to say, okay, we lost this round, we'll get you next time.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than refusing to concede the loss.
Well, I mean, and if you try to think of examples of that in history, I mean, the most recent that I think comes up is 2000, the 2000 election, when Al Gore, who had been the vice president and wanted to be president, lost nominally, at least, to George Bush. He lost the Electoral College vote, but thought that he could find more votes that had been cast for him in Florida. Went to court to try to force those votes to be counted, and the Supreme Court decided that they had to stop counting. And rather than say, well, this is all bunk and I'm not going to respect the result, Al Gore said, well, this is the system we have, for better or for worse. This is the process we've all agreed to, so I won't be the president.
Yeah, that's right. He said that he strongly disagreed with the Supreme Court's decision, but he accepted it. And I think he was right about both parts of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Bush versus Gore the Supreme Court decision that ended the recounts in the year 2000 and gave the presidency to George W. Bush was a very bad Supreme Court decision. But I also think that it was wise and statesmanlike and necessary for Gore at that point to say, I'm not going to burn the house down. Like, this is bigger than me.
Yeah.
This is bigger than one election. We need a culture where people concede elections and where we have peaceful transfers of power. 40 years earlier, there was a very, very close election between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon.
That's right.
And there were people, Kennedy won the election, and there were people on Nixon's side who thought that the election was close enough and questionable enough that they should, you know, go scorched earth and try to see if they could reverse the result. And Nixon didn't do it.
Right.
Right. It wasn't exactly the same as the Gore-Bush situation, but it's another example. And they're both examples of the ways that things work when the system is functioning well.
And you're saying that Donald Trump is challenging that. He is by the things that he's saying and doing, but almost by his very posture as the president and since really as kind of a leader in exile, that he's challenging this idea of these norms and consenting to the process, whether it works in his favor or not.
Very much so. And he told us so overtly way back in 2016. It's just that what he was saying was so unusual that people didn't really process and believe him. Like, you might remember in 2016, he was asked, will you respect the outcome of the election?
Right.
Right. He was asked before the election. And he wouldn't say that he would. Right. Any other major party American candidate, you know, in a century and more would have said, of course, like, if I win, I win. And if I lose, I lose. And we shake hands and go on. And Donald Trump wouldn't say that. And people said, oh, he can't really mean it. Of course he would respect it. But he refused to say it.
Yeah.
And then when he was in office, right, this is what the first impeachment was about. He demonstrated that he was willing to break the rules for elections in order to stay in power.
Right.
And once that happened, and he got away with it, by which I mean the Senate wouldn't convict in his impeachment, it was clear to him that he was not going to be blocked from trying to stay in power regardless of the results of the election. And nothing, it turned out, this was completely foreseeable, right? It was more important to him than staying in power. So he was willing to do whatever he could to stay in. And this is a way in which he was different from every previous person to hold the office of the presidency in the following way. Every previous American to hold the presidency of any political party, and whether I evaluate them, you know, well or poorly as a president, mm-hmm. had things that he believed in, things that he wanted for the political system that went way beyond his own continuance in power. Right? When George W. Bush left office at the end of his term, he wanted the Republican Party to go on as a strong, viable force after him.
Sure.
And the same thing when Barack Obama left office after his term about the Democratic Party. And both of them had policy objectives that they hoped would stay strong. And both of them knew, if I burn things down now, I make those things less likely in the future. Right. Like, my time is done, but more important things go on after me.
Yeah, it's almost...
President Trump did not have that sense.
Right, right. It's almost like back to the idea of the pickup basketball game, right? So you lose, and rather than punch the other team or destroy the game, you say, well, they win this round. We'll come back for another. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with more of this conversation with Richard Primus on Created Equal. We're back and talking more with Richard Primus, a University of Michigan law professor, about the controversy surrounding Donald Trump's place on the ballot in 2024. I want to get you to say what you think are the reasons that you believe Donald Trump meets the standards for disqualification under the 14th Amendment, third section. What tells you that he participated in an insurrection, and what tells you that that these states that have decided that they don't want him on the ballot because of that are the ones that to determine that? And that's of course what's before the Supreme Court now. But I want to get your take on that.
Okay, so the first thing that I want to say is, I don't expect the Supreme Court to disqualify him, right? It's always been a long, I think they should take it very seriously. I think there's a very good case. Mm-hmm. It's always been a long shot because courts in our system are very reluctant to get involved in elections on the front end. And so every cautious bone in the justices' bodies, right, tells them not to do this if they possibly can avoid it. And right. I think that that instinct is going to win out. But on the merits, I think there's a pretty good case here, right? Insurrection, both as an original matter under the 14th Amendment and as applied in later cases, doesn't have to mean the Civil War. It doesn't have to be something that big, right? The framers of the 14th Amendment could have written, you know, people who were involved in the late Civil War disqualified. They didn't. They wrote a much more general instruction about insurrection. And insurrection has been understood in the past to mean organized oppositions to the lawful execution of the authority of the government.
Right.
And especially if that is an opposition to the government's core activities for deciding who will be in power, who the government will be, seems like a pretty good claim for insurrection. And that's what January 6th was. Mm. It was an organized, violent attempt to resist the orderly transfer of authority in the government.
Right. But Donald Trump didn't show up for that insurrection.
No, he didn't, right? Here's a question that I think that a lot of people should ask themselves when they think about this case. Imagine the facts of the case were a little different. Imagine that Donald Trump had been in the front of the crowd breaking into the Capitol and had been shouting through a megaphone, "We are here to prevent the certification of Joe Biden as president and to certify me instead."
Mm-hmm.
Would he then come under the bar of Section 3? There are some people who think, no, he still wouldn't, right? But if you think if he had done that, he would be barred by Section 3, then the question is, and it's a good question, what's the difference between standing back, right, facilitating it, encouraging it, applauding it, not intervening to stop it, when you've got the power to do it and people are begging you to do it,
mm-hmm.
and saying all kinds of nice things about it afterwards? What's the difference between all that and actively participating? I think that's a hard question.
Yeah.
I think that's a hard question. And then the question is, who decides?
Right, right. Do these states have a right to decide on their own and maybe create a situation where a candidate is on the ballot in a certain number of states but not others?
Right. And now here's the funny thing about that. We think about that, and this I think is where a lot of the Supreme Court's most well-placed concern is. We think about that as a very explosive and unusual possibility, right? We don't want states deciding to keep major party candidates off the ballot
right.
for political reasons. That doesn't seem right, right? It is the case that presidential elections in this country operate as 51 different elections rather than as one nationwide election. There are no nationwide rules for who's on the ballot and how you qualify. It's done state to state. And there are lots of candidates who are on the ballots in some states and not in others, right? Usually not the major party candidates.
Right. There's people
but it happens
who,
with minor party candidates, right?
If you don't meet the qualifications, you don't get enough signatures, if you don't have, the right kinds of – well, I mean, states get to set the threshold at which you get onto the ballot.
Correct. It would be a big problem if a state said, look – our Secretary of State or our legislature, we're from Party A, so we're not going to put on anyone from Party B.
Right.
Right. That's the thing we're trying to avoid, right? But we think it's totally normal for states to enforce bona fide ballot qualifications when they decide who to put on the ballot. Colorado and Maine, strictly speaking, are not disqualifying Donald Trump from the presidency because of Section 3. They don't have the power to do that, right? I mean, if all the other states vote him in, he's in.
He would still be in, right? They're just saying that in those states, he doesn't meet the qualifications for the ballot.
Well, they're saying that the decision, they're saying the Constitution says if you took an oath to the Constitution, and then you engaged in insurrection, you cannot serve again. And they're saying, someone's got to enforce that. We here in our state have the legal responsibility and the legal power to decide who's on the ballot. It looks to us like it would be unconstitutional for this person to serve. So under our state election law, that means that we're not supposed to put him on the ballot.
Yeah.
Now, note, the federal government could clean this all up, right? If what we're concerned about is a nationwide process, Constitution.
Yeah, Congress could establish that, correct?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Constitution could remove the disability, or Congress could make a statute that says, here's what the nationwide process is going to be for determining who's disqualified.
Yeah.
In the absence of Congress's having done that, the normal way the 14th Amendment works is states have to enforce if a case is in front of them.
Right.
Now, I don't think the Supreme Court is going to decide in the way that I've just described. I think the facts of this case, right, the potential political explosiveness of the case, is likely to triumph over the normal way of doing 14th Amendment law, and they'll say, no, it's just too problematic for states to be doing this on their own. But if they do that, they'll be doing something that's a departure from the way that this normally works and from the way that I think they would do it if the stakes weren't so high.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this really wonderful conversation with Richard Primus, a law professor at the University of Michigan, about the controversy that surrounds Donald Trump and his place on the 2024 presidential ballot. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Listening to Created Equal on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and my guest is Richard Primus, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Michigan Law School. We're talking about Donald Trump and the controversy he finds himself in the middle of with regard to his candidacy for the presidency in 2024. A few states have said that because he was a participant in or aided the insurrection in 2021 in the nation's capital, that he is disqualified from seeking the office again. There is a provision of the 14th Amendment that says people who are responsible for participating in insurrections after they take the oath of office can't seek future election. Richard, I want to start this part of the conversation with a hypothetical, I guess. If the Supreme Court were to say states are free to disqualify Donald Trump for this reason, and it's up to them as individuals, right? Some states may do it, some states may not. The thing that I guess I fear is that that has an implication for voters and voter choice that is more familiar to us, I think, in history. And when you think of more vulnerable voters than most people would think of Donald Trump's supporters as being, and the history of the way that we have kept people out of democracy and process in this country, I guess I get worried. So for instance, if we flash back 12 years to 2012 and the controversy over Barack Obama that was raised, ironically, by Donald Trump, among other people, about his birth certificate and whether it was valid. What if the state of Texas or the state of Alabama had said, well, you know what, we don't think that's a valid birth certificate. We think that's, doesn't prove that he's a natural born citizen. That's a requirement of the candidacy for the president in the Constitution. And so he is disqualified. And, if he wants to go to court and fight that he can, that's fine. But would, if the court goes down that road, do we risk that kind of disenfranchisement, which would remind us, I think, of the kind of things that went on in this country for a really long time that we had to fight so hard to stop?
So there are some risks like that. What you're really talking about, in part, is the fear of bad faith decision-making.
Yes.
Right? So that is to say, suppose we thought that disqualifying Trump would open the door to the disqualification of other people who really are disqualified under the Constitution's rules. That shouldn't bother us, right? Like, I happen to think that a rule that says if you engaged in a violent insurrection against the government, you shouldn't be allowed to serve in the government later,
right,
is a pretty reasonable rule.
That's a good standard, right?
And if we could enforce that rule well, I wouldn't be worried about it at all. The worry is, in an environment where people have been disqualified for some things, might people in bad faith aggressively try to disqualify other people, right, in ways that will have bad results, right? That's the worry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very unfortunate thing that we have to think seriously about this worry, right? Because we can't count on there being good faith actors in all of the positions who will decide who gets qualified and who gets disqualified. One of the things we know is that where there's a lot of power at stake, the temptation to cut corners and make decisions that aren't fully good faith decisions grows, right? And bad things can happen.
Yeah. And I guess I would add to that the worry that our history in this country, again, has seen us indulge bad faith, particularly when the rights of more vulnerable populations are at stake. Black voters, women voters, in some cases, rural voters, and people who are not thought of as in the majority or in the mainstream. We've seen state officials, in some cases, federal officials, use this kind of privilege, I guess, or authority, in order to to leave them out of the process. And so I think that's a very, I guess I'm asking, what would you say to me to stop me from believing that that would be the inevitable outcome of permitting states to do to Donald Trump what they're trying to do now?
Well, I would say a couple of things. The first is, you have to presume a certain amount of good faith and proper operation in the system to think it's going to work at all.
Mm-hmm.
Right? A lot of the problems that you're talking about were substantially corrected by things like the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
right, which brought lots of people into the political process who hadn't been in before. There have still been lots of instances of violations of people's voting rights since then, and there still will be in the future, right? If the system works pretty well most of the time, right, if most of the actors are in good faith, and if we have levels of review, right, in court and in appellate courts for the practices that we have, then we hope that we correct most of those things. We can never run an electoral system on the premise that, like, there will be no shenanigans in it.
Right.
There will be somewhere, right? And, you know, properly functioning system, right, they're sufficiently marginal that you can continue to operate the government relatively well. The second thing that I would say is, what's the alternative? Here's a non-hypothetical case.
Mm-hmm.
A man who lost an election tried to stay president despite having lost the election, tried to use lies and intimidation and force to overcome the results of that election. Right.
You're talking about Donald Trump, the former president who's at the center of this controversy.
I am. I'm saying, like, that doesn't sound like a good idea either.
Right. To just let that happen.
Right. That doesn't sound like a good idea either. To put in power someone who has demonstrated his unwillingness to leave power through the normal rules,
mm-hmm.
right? Who has demonstrated that he doesn't care about the normal rules, that he will get away with what he can get away with, right? And to ignore the law to keep him there so as not to, like, risk other things later on seems pretty dangerous itself. This is the fundamental problem of our moment, right? This is what I mean when I say the system is not built to handle
sure.
a situation when you have someone as contemptuous of the rule of law as Donald Trump as a major political leader, because there is no choice we can make that will avoid the possibility of things getting very bumpy. If he's disqualified, things will get bumpy in a particular way. If he's not disqualified and he runs in the election, like, it's not like we're gonna have a normal, peaceful, orderly election, and if he gets a few fewer votes than his rival, he'll say, okay, I'm done. Like, if he loses the election, he'll deny that he's lost the election, and we could face other kinds of civil disorder and unrest and so forth, like last time, only on a larger scale. There's sure. no way out of it's getting bumpy.
So, and in some ways, you know, I guess what you're pointing toward is this, you know, very limited choice we have to deal with, you know, existential threats to the very idea of the republic, right? Do you act in a way that seeks to rein in a bad actor whose behavior challenges the norms and the system, or do you punish that behavior in a way that may invite other bad faith actors to take advantage of that, you know, that method or that authority for punishment and cause other kinds of existential threats to the democracy. I mean, I guess one of the questions is, you know, is there any choice that's a good one here, or are they all equally risky?
Well, they're all risky. I don't know that they're all equally risky, right? It seems to me that the worst risk is to say to the rule of law in the face of a challenge like this, roll over, right? It's a mistake to think that you can give the bully a little bit of your lunch. but then he'll be reasonable after that, right? We have purchased at a very high price in blood and treasure in the Civil War a constitutional regime in which for a very long time two major parties managed to compete for power without coming to violence, in a framework that had established a constitutional rule that said, and if you turn to violence, if you go to insurrection, you're out after that. It seems to me, and that last part wasn't tested, right? Because we never had a major party leader after that who tried to turn to violence instead of playing by the rules. It seems to me that if the first time we face that situation, we roll over, we say we're not going to enforce this rule, that's pretty dangerous right there.
You know, I keep coming back to this question of voters and their rights because I think that's more important, in fact, than what Donald Trump's rights might be to be on the ballot, right? Candidates have rights, of course, and that's part of what they're deciding here. But really, the Republic turns on the ability of voters to cast a ballot, but also to cast a ballot for their voter, for the person of their choice, right?
Of course, Steve, of course. But let me ask you something.
Go ahead.
Do you think that it's a threat to voting rights and democracy that you can't serve three terms as president?
I don't, but I do. I mean, yeah, I see what you're getting at there, which is that we have provisions that disqualify people for various reasons from running or running again. But I guess I see this as a little bit different, right? And I guess I can't put my finger on exactly why, but the idea of Donald Trump's supporters, right, who I don't agree with, I don't think you agree with their choice, but a part of me worries a bit about depriving them of the choice that they want to exercise here.
I hear you. But all elections have rules.
Yes.
Right? We don't think that the way that we choose presidents is whoever the most Americans wants to be president at any given moment gets to be president. We have a rule against serving more than two terms, right? Even if George W. Bush or Barack Obama had 80% support right now, we have rules. They can't be president. We also have rules that say we only choose a president every 4 years, right? If a president is enormously unpopular, and if you had the election today, 70% of us would vote to throw that president out and put in a new person, we can't do that, right? Because we have rules about how these elections work and when. And you can't run a system of elections without rules.
Without
those
rules, yeah. Yeah. No, it wouldn't work.
I think that the rule that says if you took an oath to this Constitution and then you engaged in an insurrection against it, you can't be president, is a really good rule. It's a rule that I'm not sure it would be plausible to argue against in the abstract. And if I may make a suggestion,
yeah,
when you say you think this feels a little scarier. It doesn't feel to you like those other rules that we all accept about limiting elections. You can't quite put your finger on why, but it feels different to you.
Uh-huh.
Let me make a suggestion about why it feels different. And, you know, try it on.
Okay.
See if it works.
Okay.
I think the reason it feels different to you, and not just to you, but to, like, lots of, like, you know, smart, thinking, well-informed people, including, I think, most of the Supreme Court, I think the reason it feels different is that the rule is unfamiliar.
Right.
We've all integrated into our normal consciousness that there's a rule that says you can only vote him out every 4 years. We've all integrated into our normal consciousness that there's a rule that says if you've served 2 terms, you're done. And so we understand those rules as a normal part of the system. The Section 3 disqualification rule about insurrections is not part of the, like, normal way that we think about how the rules of this game work, because it's a rule that's never had to be applied. We're learning, most of us, about the rule for the first time in the moment. And when you learn about a rule for the first time in the moment, you have a feeling, wait,
yeah,
is that really a rule? Is that really a rule like those other rules? It makes you more hesitant to apply. It makes some people think that it's not really a rule. It's just kind of a trick made up for Donald Trump or something like that. But here's the thing, Stephen. This rule has been in the text of the Constitution of the United States
for
a very
years.
Long
yeah.
time
yeah.
for a very good reason. And the fact that the rule hasn't had to be applied in a presidential election until now doesn't mean that it's not an excellent rule. It just means that we've always had people running for president before who aren't the kinds of people who would try to subvert the electoral system.
Yeah.
This is the moment.
Yeah. Well, and it's worth remembering, I think, when we think about this, why it had to be done, why this section was included in the 14th Amendment. And it was because there had been an insurrection, a violent insurrection that cost hundreds of thousands of lives, but also there was the threat that the people who instigated that were thinking of coming back and trying to lead again. I mean, there was not just a hypothetical possibility of that or threat of that. There was a real one, and I certainly don't want to compare Donald Trump and his followers to Confederates in that way. But there is something very real about what we're talking about here. This isn't hypothetical. What happened on January 6th of 2021 was as close, perhaps, as we've come to that kind of disruption.
It was. And here, I think, is a super important point that we should keep in the front of our minds as this story unfolds. I have given reasons why it would make sense to conclude that Trump is disqualified under Section 3.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't expect the Supreme Court to rule that way. And I don't. And I should say, it's not because I think they're politically in the tank for Trump, right? I expect that most of the Supreme Court, maybe even all of the Supreme Court, will say that Colorado and Maine should not have disqualified him. They'll probably put it on a procedural ground mm-hmm. because of their discomfort with this one way or another. We'll see exactly how that goes. But here's the super important point to remember on the day when the news headline is Supreme Court refuses to disqualify Trump. The super important thing to remember on that day is, regardless of whether the court says that what happened on January 6th disqualifies him as a legal matter under this particular provision, what happened on January 6th happened.
Yes.
A sitting president of the United States encouraged and celebrated a violent mob that attacked the Congress of the United States for the purpose of preventing the orderly transfer of power to the rightful winner of an election. That is the most important thing to remember, because that should be a disqualification, whether it's legally or at the ballot box, right? That really happened. And a person who does that, right, cannot be permitted to get anywhere near power.
Yeah. That's a great point to end the conversation on as well. Richard Primus, this was a fantastic conversation about all of the various nuances and complications of this case and this kind of constitutional conundrum, I guess. I really appreciate you being here with us on Created Equal to have our listeners understand all of it. Thank you.
Always happy to be here conversing with you.
Yeah. That'll do it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org and make sure you subscribe to our podcast.